Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. This weekend in Boston, women and their supporters will be marching in the streets 2 years after the first Women's March. That took place the day after the inauguration of President Trump, when hundreds of thousands of women marched in Washington, D.C. and in cities across the country in support of women's rights. At one point during the march in Washington, musician Alicia Keys led the audience in a chant of one of her hit songs.
Feet on the ground!
At one point in Washington, Alicia Keys led the audience in a chant of one of her hit songs.
This girl is on fire. This girl is on fire.
James Sullivan writes about this song, among many others, in his new book, Which Side Are You On? 20th Century American History in 100 Protest Songs. James Sullivan is a longtime contributor to the Boston Globe and former critic for the San Francisco Chronicle. And thanks for coming in, James. Great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us about that Alicia Keys song and how it fit into the day of protest 2 years ago.
Well, you know, I think that that song is a great example, a perfect example, actually, of what I was trying to get at with the idea behind this book, which is that what we consider to be a protest song isn't always our first thought about what constitutes a protest song. I mean, I think most of us tend to think of Bob Dylan, Pete Seeger, Joan Baez, you know, a solo performer with an acoustic guitar. But the fact is, at least in my mind, that protest songs can kind of come from anywhere, and they can be any style of music. And so that Alicia Keys song and her rendition of it, leading the crowd singing it at the Women's March, is a great example. It's a pop song. When we first heard it, we thought of it as a pop song, you know, a song about individuality. But in the context of the Women's March, you know, I think it became a protest song. And I think that Alicia Keys would probably agree with us.
It's interesting that you mentioned sort of your definition of a protest song, because, I mean, I think you're right. I think traditionally we think of We Shall Overcome. But right. With the women's movement in the 21st century, there isn't that same sort of singing in the streets kind of thing, right? I mean, these songs sort of seem to jump out of the fabric almost organically.
Right. So the idea for the book actually came maybe about 10 years ago during the Occupy movement. Uh-huh. And my thought then was that there were a number of stories at the time. Hey, there's this big social movement going on, but where are all the protest songs? Mm. And if you were watching the Occupy movement, there were actually musicians there almost every day in the park in New York, you know, well-known musicians, less well-known musicians, singing well-known songs, singing less well-known songs. And then there were a number of songs that established musicians wrote in specifically inspired by the Occupy movement. So I started thinking, you know, there's protest music all over if you know where to look for it. And some of it's on the top 40 charts. Some of it's on the pop charts.
Well, since we're marking the 2-year anniversary of the Women's March, I want to focus specifically on what you've written about the history of women's protest songs. So I want to go back to 1964 with You Don't Own Me by Leslie Gore and talk about this song for a bit. Let's listen to this first. I love that. Such a great sound. But I found your story about this song so interesting. So Leslie Gore performs it live at the Tammy Awards in 1964. So tell us what remind us what the Tammy Awards were and why this was such a significant and surprising song to hear at that event.
The Tammy Show was a filmed concert event, an all-star concert event in Southern California, that was intended to be filmed using some sort of cutting-edge technology at the time, and that was then going to be shown in movie theaters around the country. And the idea was that all the big stars of the day were going to come out and sing, and it was going to be sort of like a pre-Woodstock, except in the movie theaters. Hmm. So James Brown, the Rolling Stones were both famously there, and Leslie Gore, who was at that moment just about the biggest pop star in the country. And so her performance of You Don't Own Me on that show. It came out at the time that Bob Dylan was becoming, you know, tip of the tongue for music listeners around the country in 1964. I don't think anyone would have at the time looked at Leslie Gore and said she's a protest singer. However, over the next several years, as the women's movement became what it did in the 60s and early 70s, that song was adopted because it was specifically about the fact that women can make choices for themselves. They don't need to rely on their boyfriend or their man or their husband to make them for them.
Right. And it really represented a sort of departure in the pop song world, didn't it? Where mm-hmm. where there were usually women were sort of portrayed as being indulgent and sort of putting up with male antics, essentially.
Sure. And that was right at the height of what was called the girl group era, which was, you know, female voices, you know, sort of dominating the pop charts and pop radio. And most of those songs were about sort of being subservient to your boyfriend. And this song was absolutely a reaction to that or a response to that.
Written by two men,
exactly. They were from Philadelphia. They originally wrote it for an African-American young woman. But when they heard Dionne Warwick's version of her song, Don't Make Me Over, that song came directly from Dionne Warwick saying to her songwriters, hey, you know, don't try to make me what I'm not. You know, let me be who I am. Don't make me over.
Don't make me over. Make me over. Now that you know how I adore you. Don't pick on the things.
So the two guys from Philadelphia heard that song and they were inspired to write You Don't Own Me, which was sort of another message song, and that's where that came from.
Really interesting. I want to go back in time and talk about a genre that I love, and that's the blues. So this is Bessie Smith's version of Tain't Nobody's Business If I Do, a song that was first recorded by Alberta Hunter. But both women recorded the song in the same year, 1923. So let's listen a little bit. So I loved reading about this, and it was a bit of a revelation to me, and I'm sort of ashamed to admit this. I never associated this song with women's protests, because I've always associated with a lot of male singers over the years, including B.B. King, Willie Nelson,
sure.
Among others. So tell me about this version by Bessie Smith and how it fits into the history of protests.
Well, like a lot of songs, it's sort of an all-purpose protest song. I mean, sure, if a guy sings it, he's saying, you know, I'll do things the way I want to do it, but it was originally performed, as you mentioned, by female singers. And the tradition of female blues singers, or shouters, or belters, as they were known in the, you know, these strong voiced women in the 20s, was such that they, you know, they were singing songs like this one that were very much independent minded and saying, and that's what this song specifically represents. It's that, you know, hey, I'll live my life the way I want to, and you're not going to tell me otherwise.
Right. But fair to say that the blues of this period, not widely recognized as sort of feminist music or offering feminist music?
Sure. Although the activist Angela Davis wrote a whole book about some of these women, you know, Bessie Smith, Ma Rainey, Ida Cox, basically making this point that they were feminists way ahead of their time.
Speaking of Ida Cox, let's listen to another song from this time period, Wild Women Don't Have the Blues, by the uncrowned queen of the blues, Ida Cox.
I hear these women raving about their monkey men, about their trifling husbands and their no good friends. These poor women sit around all day and moan, wondering why their wondering paupers don't come home. But wild women don't worry, wild women don't have no blues.
Wild women don't have no blues. So tell me about this. Among other things, she's indicting women who sit at home and moan about their no-good husband. So,
right.
So this is a call for women to really get up and take control, right?
Right. And in fact, Ida Cox was one of the very first women in the entertainment world to sort of run her own business. She ran a touring company. She was the star, and she was also the owner and operator. You know, this is an example. I think that one of my thoughts in writing this book was that whole genres of music, from the blues to rock and roll to punk and hip hop, have been established on a certain level as a form of protest, you know, as a reaction to something that the makers of that music felt was being disrespected on their part.
Right. So I want to bring up a song that exemplifies another characteristic, I guess you could say, of the women's movement, and that's division. Not all women were behind it, and it's very apparent in some of the music coming from women during this time period. So let's listen to this well-known song, which sort of doesn't need an introduction.
And if you love him, I'll be proud of him, 'cause after all, he's just a man.
And of course, Tammy Wynette singing Stand By Your Man. What was the reception to this song by the general public and by second wave feminists, I guess?
Yeah, I think that the general public just sort of thought it took it at face value, you know, felt that, you know, she was saying, you know, do right by your man. But, you know, she spoke on the record many times that that's not necessarily what she intended. You know, she wasn't saying, I'm not a strong woman. I'll do whatever my husband tells me. She was saying, if he's down, help him out. That was it. So, you know, this is one of many songs that can be interpreted however the listener wants to hear them.
Interesting. So, James, you compiled a final list of songs emblematic of women's protest music, and I was struck that you didn't include Helen Reddy's I Am Woman, although you did write about it. This was released in 1971. It became hugely popular by the end of 1972. Let's listen to a bit of it.
I am strong.
So tell us about this song.
Helen Reddy actually spoke several times about sort of surprising herself that she, when she wrote this song, you know, she felt at the time that she did not feel like she would necessarily have called herself a feminist, but also looked around and felt like, you know, okay, the time has come for a song like this, and she was inspired to do it. And obviously she showed up at the Women's March in L.A. 2 years ago to sing that song and got a huge reception from the biggest crowd at any of the women's marches that happened around the country.
Hmm. Let's move on. I want to talk about another song. I had never heard this song, or if I did, I'd forgotten about it. It's called The Pill by Loretta Lynn, and it's a literal reference to the birth control pill. Let's hear a little bit.
This old maternity dress I've got is going in the garbage. The clothes I'm wearing from now on won't take up so much yardage. Mini skirts, hot pants, and a few little frills. Yeah, I'm making up for all those years since I've got the pill.
I love this song. You say this is the song that when the debate over women's reproductive rights spilled uncomfortably over into the country music world.
Yeah, well,
what kind of reaction was there?
Country music was, you know, at the time in the 60s and early 70s, certainly sort of a reactionary world. And there were a number of songs actually by strong women like Tammy Wynette and Loretta Lynn that were intended to say, hey, you know, this isn't just a man's world. But the reaction was strong enough that Loretta Lynn cut the song, I think, in 1972, and her record company didn't actually release it until 75. They told her, you know, nobody's ready for this yet. Huh. And they finally released it in 75. And it's a great song. And she knew it at the time. And, she, you know, it was frustrating for her that the record company wasn't on board with releasing it.
And when it finally came out in 75, what kind of reaction did it get?
Pretty much what the record company thought it was going to get. You know, there were a lot of, you know, radio programmers and the like, you know, not wanting to play it or, you know, banning it from their stations or whatever, because they felt like it was incendiary, or it was, you know, sort of subverting the norms in the country world, which is what it was doing.
Okay, one final song I want to talk about. It needs no introduction, so let's just dive right into it.
R-E-S-P-E-C-T.
So, of course, the legendary Aretha Franklin and Respect. Why do you think this song took off at the time?
Well, first of all, because it's a killer song, but also it's a killer song. But if you're talking about interpretations of the songs, there were those who felt like it was a song about the civil rights movement, and there were those who thought it was a song about feminism and the women's movement. So, Aretha's sister Carolyn once said, you know, it's both of those things because there are all kinds of people who need more respect. And the great story about that song, I think, is that Otis Redding wrote it, but when he heard Aretha sing it, he said, play it again, play it again. I want to hear it again. And he kept saying, you know what? She stole my song, and I can't be more proud of that fact. Like, she made it something completely different, and he was thrilled.
It's so interesting that you remind us that Otis Redding wrote it. And, of course, this is one of those facts that I heard a long time ago for the first time, and yet every time I hear it, I'm surprised about it anew because I think of it as Aretha Franklin's
just
song.
Just as Otis felt. You know, yeah. She made it her own. She took that song away from me, and that's fine because she deserves it.
Right. Right. Interesting. Well, so of all these songs we've talked about, and maybe there's one that we haven't talked about, what's the song that's had the biggest impact or staying power in the women's movement and feminism?
Oh, that's a good question. You mentioned that I Am Woman. I mean, that's an anthem. I mean, you know, I don't know if that's the biggest one, but, I'd probably go with either that or Respect. They're both songs that have certainly withstood the test of time and still are looked at as feminist anthems.
All right. Well, James Sullivan, longtime contributor to the Boston Globe and former critic of the San Francisco Chronicle, his new book is called Which Side Are You On? 20th Century American History in 100 Protest Songs. And we've been talking about women's protest songs on the 2-year anniversary of the Women's March. James, thanks so much for coming in, and thanks for this great book.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
All right, and we'll end today with Respect because that's always important, and because, like the man said, it's a killer song. I'm Anthony Brooks. Have a great weekend. Join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.